This week, the gold and silver index flew higher along with the oil market, which posted its fifth consecutive winning week. Your host, Chris Waltzek, back with you on GoldSeek.com Radio. We have another big show. This week's lineup includes top guests John Embry from Sprott Asset Management. His firm is tops in the sector. They put their money where their words emerge. So you'll want to hear his four stock candidates. He says gold remains the de facto antithesis of paper money. Just give it some time, and it will shock even the most staunch gold bull, and you'll be pleasantly surprised with the results. Then economist and best-selling author Harry S. Dent Jr. returns to the show with his latest thoughts on the Greek drama. He says the Grexit is merely the tip of the iceberg. The U.S. and most developed nations have accumulated such enormous debt burdens that collapse is virtually a sure bet. And remember, we'd like to take your questions and comments. We have a new hotline. It's open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Just leave your first name, please, or remain anonymous if you prefer. The Q&A hotline number, 1-206-666-5370. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with another must-hear editorial. GoldSeek.com Radio begins now with the market weather recap. Partly sunny skies appeared over the precious metals markets this week amid a sharp dollar sell-off, which helped the XAU gold and silver index move sharply higher, as well as the crude oil market. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, the yellow metal was off about $4.30, finishing well above $1,200 an ounce. Silver was off about less than a quarter, ending at $1,625 an ounce. The XAU gold and silver equities index was up 1.67 points, 2.5%, finishing around 71, while West Texas Intermediate crude stole the show, picking up four more dollars, ending at $56 a barrel. That's 8% in 1 week, its fifth consecutive winning week. Moving the markets this week, two Federal Reserve officials made dovish comments, citing weak U.S. economic data, a further indication that the FOMC might wait until September to hike its benchmark lending rate. Given that the cost of living in the U.S., sans energy and food, rose about 0.2% in March, the specter of inflation is beginning to reappear, improving gold's safe haven aspects. The Fed meets again in about 10 days. Meanwhile, gold rebounded on Friday on renewed concerns over the ability of Greek officials to repay their debts, sending investors to the safe haven. EU officials said they were not satisfied with the progress of the talks, while the International Monetary Fund speaker, another key lender, insisted that Greek officials needed to step up their efforts to revive their economy, warning Greek officials against delaying payments to the fund. The Greek government bonds posted the worst weekly performance since the Syriza party was elected into power about 4 months ago. The nation owns a combined payment of over $1 billion. Investors viewed the comments as a solid indication that the looming default could come to pass in the next few weeks, making gold a particularly appealing currency alternative. In related news, due in part to the dollar crash this week, gold prices are up over 5% from the March lows on the heels of the Greek concerns, as well as signs that Fed officials will hold rates steady until this September. The FOMC will meet in about 11 days on April 28th and 29th. Elsewhere, according to one media source, the CPM Group, GFMS, and Metals Focus all expect the precious metals to find a solid bottom in 2015, with prices firming later into the last quarter of the year. One of the drivers is robust demand in Asia, where investor appetite for the yellow metal remains insatiable, particularly in China and India. No surprise there for GoldSeek.com radio listeners. Precious metals, bottom line. While the impressive dollar rally hit a major roadblock this week, posting a bearish Harami pattern, plus the technical outlook for gold improved with some signs of accumulation in the weekly chart, so stay tuned. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, mostly cloudy weather appeared over the New York Stock Exchange on Friday, The Dow Jones Industrials Average ended the week at 17,826, off about 231 points, or 1.3%. The S&P 500 lost about 21 points, over 1%, closing at 2081, while the NASDAQ lost 64, off 1.3%, finishing at 4931. Two stocks which bucked the downward trend, Goldcorp and Agnico Eagle, two major gold producers with solid dividends, performed well, closing in the plus column, bucking the downward trend in equities. Driving the equities markets this week, slower than expected first quarter U.S. corporate earnings dampened traders' enthusiasm somewhat, sending some investors to the sidelines ahead of the next FOMC meeting. Investors were disappointed by the inflation report as well on Friday. The year-over-year core consumer price index was better than expected, according to the Labor Department. The Federal Reserve has noted that inflation and wage growth are key to the impending rate decision. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, our favorite seven indicator sentiment index entered the neutral zone, giving, no sign this week. I expect more range-bound trading until the FOMC meeting, with a downward bias, however. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with the big guest interviews and Robert Ian. You'll want to stay with us right here at GoldSeek. Okay, Harry Estet, Jr., editor of the free newsletter Survive and Prosper and H.S. Dent Forecast Newsletter, which offers current analysis of economic financial market trends, the author of several bestsellers. Welcome back, Harry Estet, Jr.
Nice to be back, Chris.
I'd like to start off the discussion today with news that Greece is preparing to declare a debt default unless it can reach a deal with global creditors by the end of this month. They've been tossing this around the mainline media for quite some time. Of course, the markets have started to discount the event. Let's go ahead and assume that they do follow through with their threats to pay back their bills. What does this mean for the typical investor?
What most people don't understand, Chris, is when we're this high in debt, and it's around the world, Greece is just one of the worst. In 2008, when the subprime debt started to go bad, and it was just a small fraction of the mortgage market, then it puts all debt markets on alert. I mean, right now, people are pricing in a perfect world. The Fed's going to, and central banks are going to print money forever. They won't let the economy go down. We won't have a recession, on and on. But as soon, I mean, like these frackers failing, with the oil prices down, they're going to fail. They're done. Things like this tend to put the markets on alert. You know, if Greece goes, then, when's Portugal going to go? And then when's Spain going to go? And, you know, it sets a precedent. And so the markets are acting like it's nothing, but the markets are in bubble land. They discount everything. When there's bad news, they say, it's good news because we're going to get more stimulus. China just went down 15% in their exports, which is disastrous with their already slowing economy. And the Shanghai composite went up. I mean, so that's where the markets are at. They're in bubble delusion land. So there's no way it's good that Greece exit. I think it's the best thing for Greece and for the Eurozone long term, but it is going to start something that will kind of grow. And that there's going to be more debt defaults, and the more debt defaults there are in junk bonds or fracking bonds or euro bonds or emerging market bonds and U.S. dollars that depend on commodity prices that are falling, the more all debt starts going, we have to worry about risk again, and then rates go up. And when rates go up, the markets go down.
Keeping with that debt default theme, you know, you've written recently that we're facing the biggest bubble in modern history. And I know some of our listeners, they're tired of the doom and gloom. That's what it really amounts to. There's so many purveyors of dismal outlooks out there that sometimes maybe it gets discounted. You seem to think that that's maybe a knee-jerk reaction, that we need to drill down into the numbers. Tell us more.
Yeah, I mean, what we've had, you know, everybody was worried about this in 2008 and 2009, and then the world almost melted down. We almost had the next Great Depression. But then central banks stepped in, and now up to $11 to $12 trillion. Imagine this. Inject $11 to $12 trillion into the global economy and 3.5 to 4 in the U.S. economy alone. That's massive compared to our GDP of, you know, $17 trillion. So they've staved off this, and people are now saying, these doom and gloomers, you know, they were just overreactive, and things are okay. They're not okay. Markets and economies always look good at the top of a bubble. I always tell people, you know, Japan. What did they look like in 1989 when we were saying they were going to crash in the 90s, even though the rest of the world's going to boom? They look glorious. They were at the top of the world. People were saying, like they're saying about China today, oh, Japan's going to overtake the United States economy. You have to look at the cycles. You have to realize when we're up, when we're down, when demographics are positive, when they're negative, and demographics are only negative in more countries, and that's the whole point of my recent book, The Demographic Cliff, and debt levels are $57 trillion higher globally than they were at the top of the last debt bubble in 2007-2008. So we're only more in debt. Demographics only get worse. It's only money printing that's keeping the economies going. But how long can you do that? You can't get something for nothing for very long, and that's what we have. This is a something for nothing economy, only on stimulus, but at some point, you can't get people to borrow more when they're already over in debt. You can't get corporations to borrow more when they don't need new capacity in a slowing global economy. All you've had is all this QE and money printing has gone into speculation. So people are bidding up stocks and financial assets. The Chinese recently, when their real estate market finally started to slow down, and it has gone down in the last several months for the first time in a long time. Now they're doing like we did with tech stocks. When tech stocks started to go down in 2000, everybody just switched and speculated in real estate. And then we had a real estate bubble. So we get bubble after bubble. I tell you, this is getting very near to ending, Chris. I don't know whether it's now or 6 months from now or whatever, but China has suddenly taken off for no good reason, even though their exports declined 15%. Hong Kong, where the Chinese speculate, has just gone off the roof. Germany has had a 40-50% gain. A huge gain in their market in 6 months, when Germany has the worst demographic trends of any country in the entire world in the next 8 years. So this is going to end badly.
The story of musical bubbles. We've watched, obviously, the United States, our equities market, our dollar rally, which you, incidentally, were the only guest to correctly predict not only the move, but the magnitude of the move, wiping out 12 years of losses in 9 months' time. Back to my point, I mean, obviously, right over there in Central Europe, as well as China, they may not be experiencing robust economic output, but, you know, once again, neither are we, and money flows continue to be positive into the United States and China and Germany. And I think that's mostly money fleeing. What's happening in the EU?
Yeah, and best houses in a bad neighborhood. I mean, China, yeah, they're going from 12 to 8 to maybe 6% growth this year. I think it's going to be lower than that in the future, but they're still growing at 5 to 6%. We're still growing at, you know, 2% on average when you really look at it over several years versus Europe at darn near zero. So, yeah, and Germany looks better than the rest of Europe. But I'm telling you, one of the biggest surprises, two big surprises we see in the next so many years. One is that Germany is going to just underperform. It's their demographics, just like Japan. They look great today, but they're not going to look great years from now. And the China bubble is starting to crack in real estate. And the Singapore bubble, I think, is going to be key in bursting that bubble, because Singapore's real estate got so extreme in prices. And unlike China, they're somewhat of a democracy. The citizens there who are wealthy, they're not like China. They're saying wealthy people here can't afford to buy a condo because of all this foreign speculation and Chinese and all these people. So the government cracked down and put a huge tax on foreign buying, and Singapore is just going to crater. And then if Singapore craters, then Chinese investors are going to realize we're going to crater. Chinese, the wealthy Chinese, are leaving that country at unprecedented rates. And it's one of the things keeping our real estate in Australia's and London's and Vancouver's going, is that Chinese are the marginal buyers, and they're rich and they don't care what the price is. They've just got to park their assets outside of China to get them away from the Chinese government.
But, you know, hat tip to the Singapore officials with the foresight to recognize the potential looming threat of a housing bubble. I mean, it's reminiscent of Dr. Greenspan in 1996 with his irrational exuberance speech, and everyone poo-pooed it and laughed him off, and he never once again threw out the warning signs after that. He just said, okay, I'll go ahead with the party line, and then boom, comes the hangover in 2000-2001. So, I mean, at least they have, you know, the wherewithal to step up and say, hey, we know where this is headed. This has got to be curtailed quickly. Well, back on track here, you also talk about the ramifications of this type of profligacy and that inevitably it could lead to a government wide-scale takeover of almost every aspect of our lives. Why don't you tell us more about this concept?
Have a bubble like this, and you're right, the Singapore government, by choking it off, it's going to hurt them, but it's better than letting the bubble go even higher and get more extreme, which means you have to have an even bigger downturn and correction. So what happens when these bubbles finally burst, when QE no longer works, or when something goes wrong, like the China bubble bursting or Germany collapsing economically, that's something that QE can't fight. Then the economy melts down, and that means loans go bad, banks go under, there's more civil unrest, all this sort of stuff. And hey, I'd rather be in the U.S. than China, where they have 250 million low-skilled rural migrants into urban cities that are going to be just destitute if the economy collapses and they can't keep building more condos for nobody, which is what they've been doing for the last 10 to 15 years. You're going to have major problems, major debt collapses, major government deficits, again, even civil unrest in a lot of areas. And so, you know, the best thing, protect your assets, cash in your gains from this bubble, even if you're a little early. I tell people every day in our newsletter that you're better to get out a little early than late, because when bubbles finally crash, the first crash is usually at least 20% and more likely 30 to 40%. Yeah, I'd rather get out 5% too early in a rally than 40% too late. So, you know, protect yourself and think about, where do I live? I mean, how do I protect myself? I mean, things could get, as happened in the Great Depression and has happened throughout history. I mean, it's especially what scares me the most, Chris, is when governments just are out of reality, and when they have a debt bubble, they don't restructure the debt like Iceland did. They don't deal with the real estate bubble like Singapore is starting to do in some countries. They just keep printing money. So I'm getting pretty scared. I don't know exactly how it's going to work out, but it scares me that this has gone this far and that mainstream economists think everything's okay, the government's doing the right thing. Even Warren Buffett says, oh, the government's doing the right thing.
It's interesting you should say that, because the Oracle of Omaha certainly deserves kudos for his ability to read the balance sheets, the income statements, the cash flow statements. But in the final analysis, we all saw what happened in 2007, 2008, even 2009. Berkshire Hathaway shares plummeted by the same amount as the S&P 500. Should the equities markets implode? And there's some interesting evidence that suggests that that could happen. Obviously, we're seeing some major sea change events in these markets. To see the U.S. dollar shift course so abruptly after almost 15 years, well, some people say even longer, of a downtrend. I've had some guests recently who have done considerable work and research, basically came to the conclusion that the yellow metal tends to hold up even better during extreme deflationary periods than it does during anything but hyperinflation, and that could be an interesting place to park a solid portion of one's portfolio, certainly better than paper assets. Any thoughts?
I see gold when there's either disinflation or a mild period of deflation, because gold most correlates more than anything else with inflation. And I just put out a recent report on this. I mean, it's unbelievable correlation. And gold was the absolute best place to be in the 1970s crisis, when it was inflation and recession rather than deflation and recession. On the other hand, everything's going to go down in price. Stocks, real estate, all types of financial assets. Gold will probably go down less. So relative to other assets, gold may preserve some capital, but I would rather wait for the next crash to happen.
That's a point well made, because what I was really alluding to was the end game, and I didn't make that clear. Ultimately, you talk about this urban disaster scenario where the end game starts to play out and hundreds of millions of people, maybe no power on, no garbage pickup, the grocery store shelves are bare, most of the ATM machines, you know, that $500 limit, there's no cash left. These are just some of the things that we actually saw play out back in during the Katrina disaster just a few years ago in the southern United States. So, against that backdrop, certainly you would like to have some kind of go-to product, some safe haven, as well as cash and real estate. Give us an idea, you know, in that situation, you know, why the yellow metal could be a good life preserver.
You don't want real estate. You don't want illiquid assets. You don't want financial assets like stocks. Those go down the most, and real estate is the hardest to sell. And when I'm wrong about stocks, I can sell out the next minute at whatever price. Real estate can freeze up. I think if you when you get into this sort of economy, if it gets this bad, and I think that is likely, you want tradable things. It goes back to a barter economy for a while. So if I had a choice between Krugerrands and silver dimes, I'd take the silver dimes. They're more tradable. You could buy a loaf of bread with that.
Unless mobility is an issue. I mean, obviously, you're going to want to crystallize as much of your wealth as quickly as possible. And, I mean, that's more of the end game-like scenario. What you're trying to do is find somewhere to park, you know, some of those stock and bond and real estate profits that so many people have accrued over the last few years.
You know, Chris, I also think I'm not somebody that says the U.S. dollar is going to collapse. It's only gone up, as you said, we've been predicting for years. I don't think it's going to go way higher. My target on the dollar index, which is at about, I don't know, 99 today, is that it's going to go up to about 120, another 20% in the next crisis, because a lot of dollars will be destroyed when debts default and financial assets fall. And when there's fewer dollars in wealth to change the same goods, you get deflation, and that means the dollars you have are worth more. So I like dollars. I like having some tradable silver and gold coins. I would like having things that, you know, people will want, like mini bottles of bourbon. I don't, you know, shotgun shells. I mean, in a difficult time, if you have something people want, food, anything, you know, you're going to be able to trade that for what you want in a time when a lot of other things become suspect. So I just look at it that way. Like, I would want to have a bunch of different things. And I'd want to have some gold. I want to have some silver coins. I'd want to have other tradable assets. But I wouldn't have a problem having a stash of U.S. dollars. I don't think the dollar is going to go down for the next few years. Longer term, I think the dollar will go down. But I think the dollar will hold up.
No, I just find it interesting that, you know, a Harvard-educated economist is sharing so many similarities and mindset with folks that are generally considered on the fringe of society. You know, the lone folks in the shack accumulating shotgun shells and things of that nature. I mean, you have to admit, it's unconventional. It's not what you expect to hear from the cognoscenti. People will want details. They want to know what happens if we're wrong here, and real estate is the go-to asset for the next 5 years. And equities are just in the early stages, like circa 1994, 95, and then there's another 4 or 5 years ahead.
I tell you, Chris, when I look at broad levels of valuation for the stock market, what the best models say, if you buy stocks today at these levels and valuations, that you will make -1% for the next 10 years. That is not good. Stocks may go higher, and this bubble may last longer than I expect. You know, the gains are like down to maybe 5 or 10% a year, versus if it does crash like it did in 2000, 2002, and 2008 to 9, and 1930 to 32, and 73 to 74. If we do get these kind of once or twice in a lifetime crashes, it's devastating. And when a bubble finally bursts, because the government has kept these bubbles going. So yeah, we've had two crashes since 2000, but the market's always gone slightly higher. So if you'd have hung in there, which most people don't anyway, by the way, but you would have still been okay. What happens after a crash like 1929 or 1972? The markets don't get back to those levels for 20 to 25 years. And if you sell at the bottom, you're down 60, 70, 80, even 90% in some cases. So that's what I'm worried about. We're at a point where the risk return ratios say, if you hang in there with risk assets like stocks especially, or real estate, you're likely to get hit badly in the next several years versus the potential returns if real estate keeps going up at a few percent a year and stocks at, you know, maybe 5, 10, 14% at best. And I tell you, stocks are so overvalued now, and they've gone nowhere since December of the last year. I think the upside is limited, although I admit I've been calling for this bubble to burst, and governments keep pumping it up. So I know that it's not easy to call this. But I'm like, if you just look at long term, you want to hang in there for another 5 or 10% in stocks in the next year when we could go down. My projections are down to 5,500 to 6,000 on the Dow, down 70% in the next 2 years. That's my most likely scenario when I look at the long-term chart patterns and the fundamental demographics and other cycle trends. So that's not a good risk-reward. I was just at a seminar in Whistler a few months ago, and the whole thing was about having outsized risk returns. There's rare times when the herd goes one way and everybody's bullish or everybody's bearish, where you can buy put options or you can buy assets bullish or bearish at unbelievable values and have chances for outsized returns in a short period of time. I'm telling somebody, I think you can make more money shorting stocks, just simply some small percentage of portfolio, than either being bullish or bearish on gold, just because stocks are what have bubbled up the most now. Gold bubbled up, and now it's gotten more reasonable. So it may go down further, but stocks are just and are waiting, you know, to get creamed here.
And that's interesting analysis, and I'm not going to say that I disagree with you per se, but I do think it's important to keep a more open mind here. And, you know, back in 2004, 2005, I remember the mainline media sources who'll remain anonymous talking unanimously about this ridiculous gold and silver bubble. And then another 7 or 8 years of gains were missed by numerous people who just didn't buy the obvious fundamental reasons for higher prices. I would simply underline and point to the idea of having a very diversified investment, you know, mentality. Plenty of equities, bonds. I would also note, I am not in agreement with you with real estate, that I see a raging bull market there that I expect to last for many, many years to come. You see, that's what the charts are telling me. That's what the technicals tell me. The momentum is telling me. I would caution listeners to take all of this wonderful advice that you've laid out here, most of which I'm sure is right, bear in mind that it's diversification, and then you can weigh those aspects, those different components of the portfolio, however you like, however you deem best, according to this wisdom that you've heard today. Any thoughts there?
Chris, if I would look at this diversified, I'd say a good way to be would be short stocks, long U.S. dollar, and long gold. That's those three different sectors that I think stocks will go down. I think the dollar will go more up. I think gold will go down for a while and long term will go up again. But that's a good, you take three or four things like that. I am not on with you on real estate. I think real estate, we have a unique analysis that shows in most developed countries there's going to be more people dying who are sellers from real estate than young people, young new families buying houses for decades to come. I think real estate will never be the same. It will never rally like it did from 2000, 2006. So I'm not into real estate, but there's a number of sectors you can be in that say, hey, what happens if things go up and down? What happens if there's inflation or deflation, this crisis? The one thing I tell people, especially people who are deciding, I don't know if there's going to be inflation or deflation. If there's deflation crisis or an inflation crisis, the one thing that goes down in both is stocks. I would have short stocks as my major hedge. And then you can put in some gold. Then you can put in U.S. dollar or some other currencies. Then you can put in, you know, some bonds. I think bond yields are going to spike up for a while, and then they're going to go down again. So bonds, long-term high-quality bonds are not a bad place to be in your portfolio. So I agree with you. You got to diversify risk. Just be careful on what you pick here, because in most stages of the economy, there's many places you can diversify in. But in the what I call the winter season, when bubbles burst and financial assets go down and debt deleverages, very few sectors do well. And those sectors tend to be things like high quality bonds and things like the dominant currency. In other words, people flee to safety. And I think at least at times gold will be that as well. But gold, by my analysis, is not favored by deflation, at least in the early stages.
I would just again caution our audience that your idea of an equities play being short stocks in the middle of a bull market, I would direct that to traders, fleet-footed professional traders. And I would suggest that if listeners have a portfolio of stocks, you might hedge your portfolio.
I agree with you on that, Chris. No ordinary investor should be like 80 or 100% short stocks. I would be short stocks to hedge. That's my hedge to the portfolio. I may be 30% in high quality bonds, 10% in precious metals, you know, other percentage in alternative investments, but I would have like maybe 20%, 10, 20% short stocks as a hedge.
Just as you were, just spot on with the dollar market. I've been right on stocks now for so many years, and frankly, I have no alternative but to go long because I can barely find a sector to short. What I would say here is that when I see the major trend change, which it has not, then I will be on board with you with both guns blazing.
You know how painful that can be when the NASDAQ bubble first burst in early to mid 2000, in 2 months, the NASDAQ was down 40% before it took its first bounce. That's what I'm telling people. It's too painful to wait and see if you're right about the downturn. It's better to be out of stocks and maybe you can build a short position as a hedge into it, but you wait after a bubble like this, I'm like, good luck.
I would agree with you for the typical investor, but I mean, for my Alpha Stocks newsletter, yeah, as soon as you see the trend change, I mean, but there's just no signs of that. It's all excellent analysis, but fighting the market theme can be devastating for the typical investor. You know, your dollar idea is great. I like adding some gold exposure. Why don't you give folks just some parting thoughts on what you all are looking at, maybe any other areas we haven't covered today, please?
Just keep telling people this is a bubble, and governments have kept this bubble going way beyond 2007 when it would have normally peaked by fundamental trends in technology and demographics, which is our expertise. We predicted the internet would peak around 2008 or so, and the baby boomers around late 2007, and those things happen. So the question is, when does the bubble burst? But since it's been artificially kept going with $11 to $12 trillion of free money printed, not to take into account zero interest rates, short term and long term, that leverages up even more. You know, I'm like, I still say better to get out a little early than late. I think there's a possibility we're topping here in the current time frame. We may, but I think we're also due for a 20% correction this year because we haven't seen one since 2011, even if we go to new highs one more time before this bubble bursts. So I'm just like, I'm on the side of caution, hedge your bets. And I'm just like, when you have a bubble like this, and it's been so good for so many years, take some profits off the table. Don't look a gift horse in the mouth. And do consider, if things get worse than most people are projecting, what would you want to own? What would you want to be able to have to trade and deal with people? And what assets do you think will hold up? I think real estate's going to have another crash, and I think real estate will never bubble or boom like it has in recently for decades ahead. Real estate is not what I want to go into. Maybe in India, maybe, but not here.
Well, I mean, it's a lot of interesting analysis today. I'm sure we'll get a lot of feedback from listeners. Why don't you tell folks more about some of the services you provide?
Our free newsletter is now called Economy and Markets. You can get it for free at harrydent.com. You just put in your email address. That simple. We have other levels of newsletters, but we just let people listen to us. It's a daily newsletter, very informative content, until they say, oh, you know, we like you or we love you and we want to listen to you more. So it's a free newsletter, nothing to lose. You don't have to give any more information than your email address.
All right. Well, you've been spot on with so many of your previous predictions. We're going to be watching these markets closely to see just how accurate the next group of predictions will be. Harry S. Dent Jr., we appreciate your thoughts.
Okay. Thanks again, Chris.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KI KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
John Embry, industry expert in the precious metals sector for over three decades at Sprott. It's a pleasure to have him back on the show. Welcome back, John Embry.
Thank you, Chris.
You know, we've had this dollar rally that seems to have caught virtually everybody flat-footed, erased 12 years or so of losses on the downside in a very brief period of time due to trouble in the Eurozone. Folks fleeing that region looking for a safe haven. John Williams today at Shadow Stats, and he's convinced it's doomed to failure. The greenback will collapse, sending the precious metals into the stratosphere. Any thoughts?
First thing I would say that I totally agree with John Williams, and I really admire his work. Somebody is sort of doing the right economic analysis, in my opinion. But, you know, you're right. When you look at sort of the trade-weighted dollar, which is it rose almost 25%, then you look at its components. And, I mean, basically, as you correctly pointed out, I mean, the Eurozone is a complete mess. And with Brexit as a, you know, a distinct possibility, you can understand why the Euro's weak. And then you look at the yen, which is another main component of the index. Abe's basic policies over there, I mean, he seems determined to destroy the yen. So consequently, it's weaker than the U.S. dollar. And then something like Canada, which does a lot of trade with the U.S. I mean, we've been, you know, damaged greatly by the decline in the oil price. So not surprisingly, the Canadian dollar has fallen quite dramatically against the U.S. dollar. So I think it's really wrong to say it's the strength in the U.S. dollar. I would rather characterize it as abnormal weakness in the components that make up the U.S. trade-weighted dollar.
We've been struggling to try to find a bottom in the precious metal sector for some time, but I think a lot of it has been this passion that investors have developed for equities, and in particular U.S. equities. Do you see that interest waning for equities sometime soon?
All I can say, Chris, is that, I mean, I've followed the stock market now for over 50 years, and I mean, I was a money manager for a great portion of that time. And I can honestly say that I have never seen the U.S. stock market as expensive as it is today, particularly if you adjust the accounting back to sort of the levels of the accounting, say, 15 years ago. And there's been so much chicanery in the accounting business that earnings, in my opinion, are greatly overstated. And if they were actually stated correctly, this would be the most expensive market without question in American history. But I'm not going to call for an immediate collapse in the market, because as long as the powers that be are keep stuffing liquidity into the system and the market is kind of rising, it may even go to higher levels. But it, in my opinion, over the fullness of time, is not sustainable. It, along with the U.S. dollar, will probably crash together.
You know, the London Bullion Market Association recently did a study and told the Bank of England that the gold market cannot be transparent with central banks colluding within it. To you and to many of our listeners, you know, that's just like, well, you know, tell us something we don't know.
What I find perhaps more appalling is that otherwise well-informed, intelligent people are sort of denying this reality. I know several people in the gold industry itself who say that central banks don't care about gold. I mean, that is absolutely false. They care probably about gold and silver more than anything else, because they are the sort of the antichrists of the U.S. or of all paper currency. And if they were to sort of start to reflect reality, I think this zero interest based stuff and, you know, the currencies maintaining their sort of value and what have you would be destroyed. So consequently, this is a real battle, and I do believe we're in the last throes of it.
You know, this is sort of a side note here, but an interesting article this week talks about how the Arizona governor vetoed a bill recognizing gold and silver as legal tender. And it would have made Arizona the third state on the heels of Utah and Oklahoma, which recognize the precious metals as sound money.
Well, I tell you, I think who I keep my eye on first and foremost are the Chinese, who are accumulating massive quantities of gold. I mean, and some of the other adversaries of the U.S., Russia in particular, I mean, they have been adding to their gold pile. The Indians, it's almost in their DNA. I mean, they're buying gold all the time. But it seems that in North America and even in Europe to some extent, I mean, gold has fallen off the, you know, the radar, and people are sort of still, you know, clinging to these fiat currencies, which I think are in their final throes. We will have a new currency system in the not-too-distant future, and I suspect that gold will somehow be involved in it, and at that point it will be revalued to a, you know, to its real value rather than this, you know, ridiculous value it's trading at today.
Well, you mentioned China, and we've had several top guests on the show, some of whom actually visited Hong Kong recently and noted that there were lines wrapped around buildings visiting from the mainland, desperate to pick up as much gold as possible. The prices and the volume there beyond belief, according to these folks. They also noted that much of China, it's still in some of the provinces very difficult to purchase and own precious metals. Now, that's changing, and so I think you could look at that as a positive demand factor.
No question. I mean, with the opening of this Shanghai Exchange, which will sort of represent the physical market in the world before all is said and done, I think you're going to see a dramatic change. And I believe probably when the physical market takes over the pricing mechanism from the paper market, which can be manipulated dramatically, I think you're going to see a big change, and I think we're on the cusp of that. So all I can do is encourage your listeners. I mean, this is a phenomenal opportunity to trade in overvalued fiat currency, overvalued bonds. I mean, I can't believe they're selling bonds in Europe with negative yields. This is so astounding to me. It drives me crazy. And so people say, well, gee, I mean, one of the reasons you don't own gold is because it doesn't have any yield. In this instance, it's infinitely better than a bond with a negative yield. So I just don't understand why more people haven't figured this out.
We had a guest on not too long ago who pointed out, incidentally, with decades of experience in derivatives and in the precious metals market, that his contact in Hong Kong and in Asia for size and bullion, they were looking at $1,800 an ounce regularly in Asia for any large size purchases.
I have heard that too, Chris. I haven't been able to confirm it, but it makes sense to me because if the demand figures that I think are quite valid from that part of the world are true, there is a distinct shortage of physical gold building. And I suspect that what, you know, how you're filling in what isn't being supplied by the mines and from scrap, it's still coming out of Western central banks. I don't know what the policy of our leaders in this part of the world is. I think if that is in fact the case, and it would appear to be, I think this is astoundingly negative for us Westerners.
And I also think that once this threat of a potential rate hike, which I think has already been priced into the dollar market and the commodities markets, you know, specter passes, it's going to be by the fact.
Say, like, I mean, this rate hike talk, to me, it's almost like moral suasion. I look at sort of the real condition of the U.S. economy. I think it would be suicidal to raise rates at this point. And yet they keep talking about it. They had that guy, head of the New York Fed, Dudley, out there talking that all the March employment numbers were an aberration and the economy's going to strengthen. And he's absolutely wrong, in my opinion. I don't think the economy's going to strengthen at all. I would be more inclined to think it's going to continue to weaken. And so if they want to raise rates into that environment, heaven help us.
Fantastic article read this morning regarding the true bifurcated state of the United States and really the Western world, as the majority of people, I mean, something like 70-80% struggle just to get by. And one of the arguments that this author laid out was that the CPI is so unfairly weighted, like 70% of Americans pay 80% or 90% of their paycheck, their pay stubs, their monthly take-home pay to just groceries and living expenses, and particularly their rent or mortgage.
That's very well said, Chris, for the simple reason that, I mean, the CPI is a terrible construct, and the government, you know, doctors it to make it look infinitely lower than it is. I've seen numbers that I think are more sustainable or more supportable, that, you know, the real inflation is at least 5% or maybe higher. I was just in Florida for a few weeks in March, and I can guarantee you the prices that for food and things like that were materially higher there than when I was there the year before. And yet, when you look at the reported CPI, they're talking about deflation. I don't believe it.
No, that's right. And the only way they can get away with this highway robbery is simply due to the fact that 50 million homes rely on food stamp debit cards, EBT cards, and related services. 150 million homes actually receive some type of assistance. And without that, you know, were that withdrawn, virtually overnight, there would be a disruption in the streets.
Well, that's a very good point. And I mean, the idea that the U.S. can ever wrestle its budget deficits under control as long as that condition exists is ridiculous. I mean, and if they did try to sort of bring about austerity and cut back in these support programs for the bottom 50% of the society, I think you would have social unrest, to put it mildly.
Well, as we wrap up, in the past you've had some companies that were on your radar screen that you thought were showing some relative opportunity. Anything that you'd like to leave with the listeners today?
It's a rare opportunity, and the opportunity has persisted, quite frankly, because these things are continually being brought under pressure. I think there's enormous short positions that are being protected to some extent. But, I mean, I think you can buy quality stocks that are sort of mining in geopolitically safe areas. Like, I happen to love Agnico Eagle, which is a Canadian-based company with, you know, big production. I love Goldcorp because it's got, you know, substantial production. It's a good quality company. And in the smaller space, there's two companies mining up here in Canada, Lakeshore and Westome, that I think are pretty pristine. And when the gold price reflects reality, the amount of money these guys are going to make is going to be spectacular.
Well, it's always a pleasure, John Embry, and we thank you and all the folks at Sprott Asset Management for your time today. Would you like to leave any contact information or maybe just an overview of the services that you provide?
No, as you know, I mean, we provide our physical trusts in gold and silver, and I think they're quality products because you can be assured that the gold and silver is there and it's audited. You know, we provide a lot of information. You can just go to, you know, www.sprott.com and, tune in and see what we got to say.
Very good. We're going to look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com radio.
Chris, it's always my pleasure.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Big changes are surfacing worldwide faster than most people can keep track of them or sort them out. A major point of discussion this week is an anticipated $46 billion trade route China is set to unveil in an infrastructure spending plan for Pakistan to open a new trade route across Asia and ultimately challenge the U.S. as a central player in that region. The China-Pakistan Economic Corridor will make Pakistan the conduit between China and markets in Central Asia and South Asia. Essentially, it will create an access and growth point to nearly 3 billion people, which is almost half the global population. This kind of long-term expansion and growth will create significant opportunities for trade, for infrastructure, for geopolitical realignment, for monetary changes, for gold, and for demand for raw materials and natural resources, which, for the moment, seem to be depressed in every market. Coinciding with this development has been lots of talk and speculation about the AIIB, the Asian Investment Infrastructure Bank. Countries the world over have been signing on to this institution, which is regarded by some as a potential rival for the IMF. And at the end of the day, 3 billion people whose living standards are set to rise because of increased trade over the next generation spells big money, big banking, and big opportunity. It should come as no surprise to anyone that financial self-interest and the ability to profit ultimately transcends most cultures, most boundaries, and most divisions. Where this will go and how fast it will develop will be inspiring to watch. It's going to move fast and will both simplify and complicate the world stage. The world has become much bigger and is going to get much bigger. Maybe this is why a significant portion of Apple's gold watch sales are expected to come from the China and Asia markets. And in reference to last week's commentary, I did keep my appointment at the Apple store here in Las Vegas and test drove a $15,000 Apple Watch. Only a handful of Apple stores nationwide are showcasing the gold watch for customers. Initially, I was told that no videos would be allowed, but I was allowed to videotape the entire showing of the gold watch. Be sure and watch it. It's worth a look. I'll post the video at conquerchange.com. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with conquerchange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ Conquer Change. Thanks, Chris.